Les colloques du Collège de France.
Welcome back, and at the start of the final talk of the afternoon. It's been a very full day, each talk full of richness. So it's great to see everyone's hung on for another talk, which I'm sure will be equally rich. And it's also one that needs a bit of gesturing in order for me to give you the title, which I'll try and do. Guises of I. So over to Sam.
Thanks very much. Thanks. Thanks everyone for coming. Good to see you all here, and I hope to meet those whose names. Well, I hope to meet everyone, but I hope to meet those names I know and that I haven't yet met face to face yet. So please come up to me and have a chat. Really would like to thank the organizers, everyone who is involved. I feel very honored and humbled to be here. And I just think it's been an extremely well-organized workshop so far. The synergies between the talks are unbelievable. I keep writing down things that relate to my own slides, but I can't hope to add. So I hope you'll just notice the things that I'm talking about that are similar to the things that have already been spoken about. Okay, so let me get started. So I thought before I launch into the talk proper, it would be helpful to go through some preliminaries. This first slide is maybe not as necessary as I thought, but I just thought going into an interdisciplinary workshop, I should say a little bit about my approach. So I'm a philosopher of language. So what I'm going to do is clarify a theoretical perspective, first and foremost, and in its details, which you'll have to register and notice, will differ from certain others that could be taken. And so being really careful and clear on that is what I see as one of my main jobs. This is not going to be unrelated to, it's not going to be a sort of a priori enterprise. It's going to be related to possible ways of anchoring future empirical research, and it certainly has empirical consequences and could be overturned by an experiment. However, and you'll see from the nature of what I'm doing eventually why this is, the arguments I use at this stage are going to be qualitative rather than quantitative. Further thing is that as a philosopher of language, I'm going to be focused on language. So actually other public signs are going to arise too, but I'm not going to speculate about things more in the domain of philosophy of mind or psychology. I have some views, but I would feel very embarrassed to try to put them forward in this venue. Okay. Another piece of preamble is the terminology I'm going to use. So I'm going to actually distinguish between discourse referent and discourse file. And at this stage, what you need to know about that is that the discourse referent is going to be the sort of objective counterpart to the discourse file. So the discourse file is a mental record that's supposed to keep track of this objective element and could fall short of doing so in a number of different ways. And in a moment, I'll say a bit more about my general perspective on discourse reference that will help with this. But I guess an obvious thing to get out of the way, and Karen already had a quote from Haim about this, is that the objective thing isn't just the thing in the world, the real world entity that, in a certain sense, discourse files are tracking in many cases. It's a different objective thing. And discourse reference, in my sense, while objective, don't map one-to-one onto real world objects. So they must be regarded as distinct from them. Having said that, my actual practice of speaking, I have never figured out a way to, without extreme awkwardness, always keep the two things distinct. So sometimes I'm just going to kind of blend discourse referent and the corresponding object together when there is one, and I hope you'll forgive me for that. Okay, so now, again, penultimate preliminary is I just want to express something that will be informing the talk but won't be the focus of the talk, which is just my basic orientation towards discourse reference and discourse files. So it's inspired by this quote from Kartanen's seminal paper, Discourse Reference. And I think maybe like him, using some kind of metaphor is helpful here. So just like this wonderful building we're in right now needs rooms, an interpretation, so any building needs rooms, an interpretation of a discourse needs to be organized into files, into separate locuses of information. Again, it's so hard to talk about it. when we're thinking about the difference between, say, the discourse referent and the discourse file, we can think again in terms of like the architect's blueprint specifying how a particular building should be built, and it may or may not be built precisely to those specifications. So similarly, a discourse specifies how the information it contains should be distributed among files, right? And so the sort of what is specified is the objective thing, is the discourse referent, and what actually gets built might differ from that in different ways. Okay, so that's my helpful metaphor. When it comes to talking about it more concretely, I still have to remain pretty abstract. So the idea I have, I'll just say what's on this slide and see if it works. So discourse reference is determined by what it takes to understand a discourse. And I put that in quotes because you'll see that I include things other than text. And hence belong to the semantics of that discourse. Discourse reference, in a certain sense, correspond to separate identities that are part of the meaning of the discourse. And failing to keep an appropriate number of records, i.e. discourse files, to track these separate identities that are in the blueprint of the discourse, results in failure to understand the discourse. And then I just have this further note that if talk of separate identities is too obscure, you can think of this as a kind of prescribed standard of information compression. And this will kind of work nicely with this example. So here's a paragraph of text. And the idea is, roughly speaking, for each, we could parse this syntactically, and then we could make a kind of overly general semantic claim about it, which is roughly that each noun phrase, or determiner phrase if you prefer, corresponds to a reference to something, or corresponds to an argument of which the predicate needs to be filed under. The discourse also prescribes that certain of these noun phrases need to be grouped together. So in particular, all these ones in bold just correspond to one file, okay? So all these references are kind of compressed into one, if you like. And that's the first discourse referent. And then there's another set of three here, which also have to be compressed, but they're compressed into a separate file. So in order to understand this text properly, you have to at least come up with those two files, and you have to realize that how they're associated with points in the text, with noun phrase tokens in the text. Everyone following so far? Is that okay? A quick thing, because this isn't going to be important for the rest of the talk, but I do want to mention something that actually follows from taking the view I just, or the general take I just expressed about discourse reference seriously, is that there's not necessarily a close relationship with co-reference, even linguistically mandated or manifest co-reference. Sure, that's going to be an important guide, and in a lot of cases is going to correspond, but it doesn't necessarily correspond to the way the information in the discourse is meant to be divided up into files. Okay, it just doesn't follow that it has to be the same thing. So in particular, a discourse can simultaneously indicate a need for separate records, i.e. distinct discourse reference, while simultaneously containing an anaphoric connection or something like that that indicates that both records concern the same real world entity. So that's just a conceptual possibility given what I'm saying about discourse reference. And people have brought up various cases that do this. So this is actually a case of mine that was in an earlier draft of my variableism paper, but it got cut. But I think it works. François has other examples at the start of chapter 3 of Mental Files in Flux. So in this situation, this scenario, which is a masked ball, we can imagine that Byron, one of the suitors, doesn't realize who Maria is at the ball. And we could express this with either of these two sentences. One involves repeating the name and one involves anaphora with a reflexive pronoun. But I think to understand either sentence, we need to construct different files. We need to construct a file for Maria as Byron thinks of her, and then this other person that Byron doesn't realize is Maria, but in fact is Maria. And that's notwithstanding the fact that they're going to be sort of manifestly co-indexed. Okay, this is not going to come up, but I just thought it was a big enough difference from how a lot of people think about discourse reference that I should mention it. Okay.
Sorry, I just need some water.
Well, I would read those two in different ways. First one is that Maria was dressed up as Maria, and the other one that Maria wasn't dressed up.
Still, I think we need different files to keep track of the different things that Byron is claimed in the discourse that Byron believes about the two different people. Like, if we just had one file and all that information got smooshed together, we wouldn't be understanding what's going on. That's the only point I meant. I didn't mean anything deeper than that. Okay, so I've taken a couple of things from the blurb for the workshop description that François mentions, and just to sort of contrast them with the approach that I'm going to take. Sometimes the contrast is minimal, but so he mentions, or suggests at least, that discourse files are temporary. I think he was a little more straightforwardly endorsing that view in the comments at the beginning. He's curious, though, about the relationship between discourse files and the long-term mental files. I'm not going to use for some reason I'm using the term long-term mental files rather than the standing mental files or encyclopedic files, but that's what I mean by that. And also mentions that discourse files might not be existentially committing. These points are echoed by similar points by Kartanen, but somewhat different. So Kartanen does speak of short-term discourse reference with a limited lifespan. But he does go on to note that they don't really go away, right? He says, actually, you can access them again later as long as you have the right kind of setup. So that's kind of interesting and speaks to this topic of the workshop. I'm not going to go into that myself. And Kartanen also, relatedly to the issue of files not being existentially committing, says that discourse reference is a linguistic matter, not an ontological one. So it's a bit open-ended what that might mean. But I'm going to sort of adopt a different perspective in both cases. So I'm going to say that discourse reference are universally long-term. In fact, I don't believe they're even restricted to a particular conversation. And so I just think that discourse files, the files corresponding to discourse reference, just are the encyclopedia entries. Of course, if they're not activated, they might get forgotten, just like other memories, other long-term memories. I should add in here that that doesn't mean there isn't anything corresponding to the pointers and things like that other people are talking about, but we'll see in a moment how this plays out on the view that I'm going to give. Now, discourse reference, as we've seen, must be tracked by discourse files, but do not necessarily... There's nothing in the definition that I gave of what a discourse referent is as just a room in the building, like it's a carving up of information into discrete parcels. There's nothing in that definition that makes us think that they necessarily have to track or correspond to real-world objects. And, of course, the paragraph that I gave was from a novel, so it's not, there's no assumption that there's something in the real world corresponding to Lowell Stein. However, the reason I bring this up and make this tenuous connection to the description of the workshop is that I don't think this makes discourse reference linguistic per se. So I would also reject Kartanen's characterization. And that is going to be relevant in what I do, because I'm going to talk about non-linguistic signs as well and understanding those in this connection. Okay, so finally we get to the talk. So I'm going to argue that tokens of I, the first person pronoun, are only understood when they're resolved to long-term discourse reference or encyclopedic mental files. So I'm going to suggest that this process secondarily, so that's my main claim, then I'm going to talk a little bit about the process. So I'm going to suggest that the process often recruits non-linguistic means of identification, such as facial recognition and voice recognition. And I'm going to give a sketch of an account where we can think of different faces and voices as name-like signs, and recognition as the process of resolving an indicated face or voice to a familiar discourse referent. And the indication is via some kind of deixis. Okay. So the starting point is, this is not the usual view, and I need to introduce what the usual view is. And I should say that this is my interpretation of Henk Sievert's very influential paper about this, where he's attempting to sort of blend Kaplan with DRT. It may be that I've gotten this wrong, but I think there's enough people out there who think something like this to make it worthwhile mentioning, and it just seems to me that this is the received view. I'm not going to go into everything that's in Sievert's paper. I'm just going to talk about the bit that's relevant to the bit that I object to. Okay. So the way I would describe his view, very unfairly and roughly, is that he analyzes indexicals such as I as devices of utterance-dependent discourse reference. So his idea is that when an utterance is made, a discourse referent U for that utterance event is created, i.e. when someone makes an utterance, we have to make a record of that. We start a discourse file for that utterance. And then a further discourse referent is just automatically created along with it, because we infer whenever there's an utterance, there's an agent of that utterance or an author of the utterance. Now, if the utterance in question contains a token of I, then that token is properly interpreted on this view by resolving it to a discourse referent with X's, precisely X's profile, this discourse referent we just created, i.e. one that is recorded as being the author of U. So I think this suggests what I'm going to call a low bar for understanding tokens of I. So it seems to me it just follows that on Sievert's view, it's sufficient for an audience to understand I if they just record that an utterance is taking place. They notice the utterance and they register it. They use general knowledge to infer that this event has an agent and create a record for that inferred individual. And then they interpret I according, they know the English meaning of I. They know it's a first person singular pronoun, and they interpret it accordingly as referring to the agent of the event in which it's tokened. Okay, that's all you need to do to successfully understand a token of I on this view. And I think a good analogy of this analysis is it's just like bridging anaphora, which is another kind of dependent reference. So an audience understands, here's the classic example of bridging anaphora, an audience understands a token of the driver in relation to a passing bus. If they record that the bus went past, that there was an event of a bus driving past, they infer that that event had an agent, a driver, and create a record for that inferred individual. And then they interpret the token of the driver as referring to the agent of the event of driving they've just witnessed. So again, they just need to register the event, use general knowledge to construct another discourse referent satisfying a certain role that they know will be filled, and then they resolve the token to that discourse referent they've just created. So the slogan is this low bar Sievert analysis is just like bridging anaphora. So It's not, just be careful to say what I disagree with here. So it's not that I think, so I think Zivat's analysis consists of two plausible parts, right? So I agree with him that a token of I must be resolved to a file X such that X authors U is recorded in storage, is presupposed, with U being the file for the utterance of in which the token occurs. So I agree that that's how that's the presupposition on I, for instance. And I don't disagree either with the idea that upon witnessing an utterance, we construct a file for it, and we are also able, by inference, to construct another file for its author. So I don't disagree with those parts. I just disagree that if we then go ahead and resolve the anaphora to that file so created, we have correctly understood the utterance. We've done enough to understand the utterance. So is that clear? I'm not going to go into the analogy with Donnellan. So there's two theoretical issues that I want to bring up first that trouble me about the analysis. The first issue is a worry about Kartanen's basic requirement from the earlier slide. So his basic requirement is that we're meant to keep track of the individuals mentioned in the text and, you know, create a file where all the references to the same person are kind of collected together. But this Zivat approach doesn't do that, right? It allows, so when I occurs in multiple utterances, the same conversation by the same person, this approach allows the audience in principle to store the information in separate discourse files, one for the agent of each distinct utterance, right? So there could be separate files. But intuitively, to satisfy Kartanen's basic requirement, we should keep them, that we should collect them into the one file. So if we have a dialogue where Estragon makes two different utterances, both including containing a first-person pronoun, we want those to go in the same, be connected to the same file. In fact, we want more than that. We want it to be connected to the file that these ones are connected to, too, right? So that's the first theoretical issue I have. Second issue is more complicated, and it's in fact what led me to think about this. Think about all this in the first place, and when I was invited here, I thought, I should write up this response to this case. So Andrea Onofri in 2022 came up with a case that's I think it was directed at me, but I think it's a problem for all Frege-ians. So I'm going to make it seem like other people are on the hook. Okay, so here's Onofri's case. By the way, people here should... This is where I got the case from, and I think it is the earliest occurrence of the case, but if it comes from someone else and I'm misattributing it, or it was came from joint work or something like that, you should please tell me so I don't make this mistake in future. So here's the case. Onofri imagines a case where the same speaker S in two different contexts, a piano concert and a political rally, utters the same sentence containing an indexical, I am a musician. And then we have a hearer, H, who doesn't recognize S in the second context and so thinks a different person is speaking in each case. Intuitively, Onofri claims, H understands the two utterances, yet believes the one and disbelieves the other. And what I think is, as long as we're assuming the bar is low for understanding I, and in particular doesn't require that an audience recognize someone who's familiar to them, then I agree that such a case would seem plausible, that there's no reason to rule it out. But the same sort of case is a problem for a Fregean. So what is a Fregean? A Fregean is someone who thinks that kind of two things. One is that we have a sort of fine-grained, transparent kind of content, which is what is transmitted in cases of successful communication. So Fregeans are committed to the thesis, one, first of all, that understanding an utterance means assigning it the thought that was expressed. So as long as the interpretation matches the expression, then you've understood. Whenever you've understood, the interpretation is going to match the intended interpretation or what was expressed, what was intentionally expressed. But they also think that these thoughts are transparent, so that one cannot rationally believe and disbelieve the same thought. So there's a kind of level of content that the Frege-ian belief satisfies these two theses. So what's the problem then with Onofre's case? Let's use P for the thought that S expresses with each utterance in our earlier case. And what we've claimed, or a lemma that we've arrived at, is that H understands both utterances and indeed believes the first utterance and disbelieves the second. So that means that H believes that P on the one hand, but also disbelieves that P on the other. But this ends up conflicting with thesis two. Does everyone follow that argument? Sorry, I did that a little bit confusingly, but happy to go back over it if there's a question. Good? Okay. Okay. So now I want to move ahead to away from theoretical issues to sort of my sort of reasoning and thinking about why this low bar is should be should be thought of as not a satisfactory account of understanding of indexicals like I, and that in fact we should have a more robust account of what understanding requires. So Ruth Millikan is on board with this. So in her very good 1990 paper, she claims that to interpret an indexical, one must already know, as she says, independently and ahead of time, who or what stands in the relevant relation to the utterance event. So you need to understand a token of I in particular, you need to know who is the author already in order to understand it. And she uses these two examples, to which I'm going to add a third. She borrows this example from Perry of you receive a postcard in your letterbox. It's unsigned, though. The person who sent it has forgotten to sign it. And it says somewhere on it, I'm having a great time. The intuition is supposed to be that you sort of have no idea what this is saying until you've figured out who sent it. Okay, this is supposed to be in support of Millikan's claim. She has another example. In the dark, a friend calls out, I'm over here. But if the audience is deaf in one ear and can't determine where the call is coming from because it's dark and because they're deaf in one ear, they similarly have not reached a satisfactory understanding or interpretation of the utterance. My example is this one. The thing that I'm adding is just that you actually see the person who's making the utterance. So you're sitting in the back of the classroom, working on your laptop. Someone appears in the classroom and writes on the board, my class today is canceled. And you notice this happening and you barely register it, and you don't actually know who it is because you don't look at their face. And so you're not sure if it's the class you're supposed to be taking that starts in 10 minutes is canceled, or if it's one scheduled for later that day. So I think, again, you even though you saw the person who I refers to or my refers to, you don't fully understand. Okay, so whatever. I anticipate a lot of people saying I disagree with all of these examples, and I have good theoretical reasons for thinking otherwise. So yeah, I think we have to do more than just play around with examples like this, which obviously have been around forever in the literature, and people are used to them by now. So I wanted to add something a little bit new to this, to the argument, and then I'll move on to sort of implementation ideas. So what I wanted to look at instead is kind of slightly more indirect indications of understanding. So in particular, I wanted to look at stage setting, what I'm going to call stage setting, and also repair. So I think we could get a good sense of what constitutes proper understanding, for instance, if we notice that when that bar isn't reached, people suddenly do something to fix the situation. So that's repair, okay? And similarly, since we don't want to have to repair all the time, there might be sort of anticipatory stage setting that prevents things from going wrong. And so I think that stage setting and repair support this more robust view of understanding that is roughly characterized by Millikan, but I'm going to call it understanding in a robust sense that requires recognition. And sometimes I'm just going to shorten that to robust understanding, as opposed to the low bar in Zivad's account. Okay, so, right. So I guess the argument is obvious, but I'll just fill it in. If the requirement for understanding I is this suitably high bar, then just knowing that our goal is to achieve understanding comfortably accounts for why these practices are in place. Otherwise, you have to explain them in some other way. I mean, maybe that won't be hard, so that's why this is a kind of indirect abductive argument. Okay. So here's a quote from the sociologist Irving Goffman. And what it's about, I won't read it out, but what it's about is when we don't simply know of a person, but we know them personally. So this is terminology that he uses that I'll explain in a moment. Basically, we're in a position to recognize them. We've encountered them before and we know them by face or voice. Then in those situations, he says we have the right and obligation to do what he calls social recognition, which he exemplifies with exchanging a nod, a greeting, or a chat. Another piece of Goffman terminology is, and this I thought was, okay, this is one thing I'll mention. This relates a little bit to Ellen's talk. He moves away from social identity in parts of this book. So social identity is more the traits that you have or the type of, the kind of person that you are. To personal identity, which is what you think it is. It's particular to the individual. And he says stuff like this, which seems very reminiscent of what we've been talking about. So if two people are strangers, he says, an encounter between the two of them is an opportunity for each to build up a personal identity of the other. And he has a pretty low bar for that. He describes it as, at the least, a memory of having seen the other person conducting themselves in a particular way. So you store something about them in long-term memory. Otherwise, the encounter, he says, is not one of this sort. It's a totally anonymous encounter. Sounds like he's talking here about starting a long-term mental file. And so I'm going to use personal identity I'm going to take it that what Goffman is talking about when he talks about personal identity is roughly a long-term discourse referent. Then we can see that the exchange of nods or similar gestures that constitutes social recognition is an acknowledgement that each party has been placed, as he puts it, by the other person. Each has registered the personal identity of the other, meaning that they've retrieved the appropriate, familiar, long-term mental file. So simplifying that, social recognition effectively asserts, so this nod or whatever, this exchange of nods, effectively asserts that the stage has been set for robust understanding in my sense of tokens of I in the conversation. Now I want to dig down a little bit deeper and look at some early conversation analysis accounts of phone calls. So another famous name, Emanuel Shegloff, has in his dissertation studies, which is titled The First 5 Seconds, studies the openings of phone calls. And I think his study shows them to be oriented around social recognition. And what he emphasizes is how they're oriented around the identification of the caller. Okay, so, right, a phone call consists of, in case it's not obvious, one person who initiates the call, the caller, and then another person who picks up the phone, the receiver. Okay, so I'm going to sometimes use my hands to help us understand this because it gets a little complicated. So no one in this room will remember this, but phone calls used to begin on the receiver's end with an anonymous mechanical ring. Okay, so it's just this anonymous ring. Shegloff starts off exploring what sort of category this belongs to, and he describes it as a summons, and he thinks it belongs with such behaviors as tapping someone on the shoulder or calling out their name, right, to get their attention. So they're things to get the attention of the other person. Now, he goes on to note that if someone were to tap you on the shoulder, You might respond to the summons with yeah or what, something like that. But interestingly, although this won't seem surprising, Shegloff found that such responses hardly ever occurred as ways of answering the phone. He only found that that was a way of answering the phone in one kind of situation, which is where the receiver thought they already knew the identity of the caller, right? So for instance, if you know, the caller initiated a call, receiver receives the call, and then they get cut off. And so there's another ring, and the receiver answers and says, yep, something like that. They're expecting that this is the same caller again. Now, the further level of this that he notices is if a caller were to receive an answer of yeah from someone they did not think was expecting their call, so they make a call and then the receiver just says yeah, they immediately issue a repair in which they identify themselves. Because what's happening is the caller assumes that the receiver was expecting someone else. Like, they don't know that I'm calling, so they must be thinking that someone else has just called them and I need to repair this situation. So we have a case here where the failure of robust understanding elicits a repair that seeks to set things right again. And then the rest is kind of obvious. The more usual answer to an anonymous phone call summons was, hello, so-and-so speaking. But Shegloff analyzes both of these, either or both, as polite requests for the caller to identify themselves. Give very quick highlights from his analysis. So he takes the self-identification in such contexts to function as a request to reciprocate. So the person is saying so-and-so speaking because they're wanting you to reciprocate. So they're requesting in a polite way the caller to identify themselves. And he goes on to say that even if hello is interpreted just in its pure greeting sense, actually it still has a similar function because hello always elicits a reciprocal greeting, and that would allow the receiver or give the receiver an opportunity to identify the caller by their voice. So he thinks that that can have the same function even if you think it must be a greeting. Okay, so that's the argument. I'll just summarize what it's kind of saying. So I think a good explanation for these practices of stage setting and repair is that robust understanding is sought. So when a familiar person speaks to us and then goes on to utter a token of I, we're required to interpret their token by retrieving the appropriate familiar discourse file. If the person is instead not known to us, then we interpret the utterance using a new file. So that's the ideal. That's what the blueprint says you should do. Now, that doesn't mean that's what's going to happen in every case. So here, it's obvious, a familiar person, or maybe it's not that obvious, so I should go through it carefully. A familiar person is one for whom we have built up a personal identity, so we have some encyclopedia entry for, basically. It's someone we at least know of, right? We might not know them personally. And familiar people can generally, I'm simplifying a bit, but familiar people can generally be recognized by name, by face, or by voice. So this explains why when we begin a conversation, we tend to introduce ourselves. We might know of the other person, but just not know them personally and so not be able to recognize their face. So this would be something that an exchange of names would facilitate. We'd find out that we do know of this person, and so we can and should resolve them to the familiar file. But it also helps in future meetings as well, if we think that might happen again. And once you're personally acquainted with someone, you know them by face or voice, it's sufficient to acknowledge with a gesture such as a nod or an eyebrow flash like that, that you've recognized them from their appearance. Alternatively, you can just greet the other person by name, which is an unfakeable signal that you've been able to place them, right? So I'm going to go into hurry-up mode a little. Although there's not too much to go. So how does this work in a bit more detail? So Kartanen, in the same paper, has an account of how names should be interpreted, tokens of names. Now, it's a bit simplistic, especially given the Byron Maria example that I gave earlier, but I'm just going to go into simplistic mode for the end, with one exception. So basically what he says is that you just use the familiarity or novelty of the type of name as a cue to whether you need a familiar or a novel discourse reference. So if you encounter a name token of a type that you haven't encountered so far in the text, you start a new file. If you encounter a name token of a type that you've already seen in the text, then you retrieve the file that you used for the previous token of that type. So same goes for faces, same basic principle. A new face, a brand new face, again, unless we can use names instead to figure out, use our introductions to figure out who this person is, but absent that, we interpret a novel face by opening a new file, a familiar face by retrieving the appropriate file from memory. So faces are the same as names. Now, I've been talking about eyes so far, but facial recognition can play the same role interpreting other personal indexical pronouns within a like face-to-face conversation or phone conversation. So obviously when there's more than one person present and there's more than one face, there's a kind of ambiguity. So you use a combination of different pronoun types. I'll let you figure out how this works. Different pronoun types, and possibly if there's a need for it, deictic gestures to resolve which face is the relevant one or which face you've already interpreted is the relevant one. And there's interesting connections here that in the sense that the gestures you use actually differ with the different pronouns. We can talk about that later. So what's the picture here that I'm trying to elaborate? So if you've done any philosophy of language or linguistics about demonstratives, you'll know the example that we can point to an empty chair that's usually occupied by a certain person to indicate that person. Well, I'm suggesting something similar. So we point to, but more subtle, we point to a physical body to indicate the discourse referent or personal identity, if you like that terminology, that it represents by its unique appearance. By the way, this analysis, if accepted, gives us another reason to think that recognition belongs properly to understanding, because recognition just constitutes the understanding of a non-linguistic sign here, namely the appearance. Final complication, and then I'll go into conclusion. So the final complication is that it's not individuals to core that are familiar, but their social personas. So when Lois Lane encounters Superman disguised as Clark Kent, what does she have to do? She has to recognize the Clark Kent persona. She has to resolve that appearance to the Clark Kent discourse referent, right? When she sees Superman out of disguise or in his regular getup, then she has to resolve it differently. Now, this is important because of what I said before about the rule being that robust understanding requires that when someone is familiar, we have to retrieve that discourse file. Well, that has to be conditioned by the guise or the persona that they're occupying, right? So if Superman is familiar to us but Clark Kent is not, then depending on which guise Superman is in, we may be allowed to open a new file. Like if he's in the Clark Kent disguise, then what's required for understanding is just opening a new file. We're meeting a new person, Clark Kent. Okay, this is obvious. Okay, so let me just summarize what I've done and then stop. So what I've been asking in the talk proper is, what is the analog of Cartan's procedure of understanding a text, this procedure of sorting information into files, when it comes to indexicals such as I? So I've argued that it's necessary to retrieve a familiar long-term encyclopedic file when the speaker is known to us in the persona that they are presenting to us. That's the view. The way this works is as follows. When we encounter somebody, we attempt to place them either by reading their physical appearance or by being told their name, either of which would be associated in memory with a long-term file. We generally acknowledge receipt of the relevant signal of personal identity, usually by a simple gesture, a nod or an eyebrow flash, or others. We might instead determine that the other person is unknown to us, in which case the proper procedure is to open a new file. Once the individuals present in the encounter have been assigned discourse reference, we can then indicate a particular one of those discourse reference by a combination of pronoun and gesture. Okay, we use a particular pronoun with a particular person feature, and possibly if there are two people that I could be addressing, then I might use my gaze as an additional way to disambiguate which physical person I'm trying to get you to read in order to extract a discourse referent from. So indicating a face is in this way analogous to tokening a name. So in short, and this is the final slide, while temporary files or other representations may need to be recruited, so these are the pointers or whatever, in the course of interpretation, my thesis is that the final interpretation of a personal indexical pronoun, such as I, required for understanding it on the carton and model, is a long-term encyclopedic file. And though I haven't argued for this, we might wonder in the discussion if this is true of indexical pronouns, which seem to be a good case for temporary files, or may have seemed at first to be one. It may be true of all kinds of noun phrases. Okay, that's it. Thanks for listening all the way through.
Thank you, Sam. So as before, I'll look for questions now, but I'll also take new people. If you haven't got a question now but want to come in later in the discussion session, then just put your hand up later on. And let's start there with Rory.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask you what you would say about the following kind of admittedly very imaginative case. So imagine you're a good friend of Superman, Clark Kent, and you're hanging out with him in his apartment, and he's dressed as Clark Kent in a suit, you know, in his Clark Kent guise, and you're having a continual conversation. Let's say he's complaining about his relationship problems, and he says, well, hold on a minute, I'm going to keep on talking, and he goes into his bathroom to change into his Superman clothes and comes out as Superman, you continue the conversation. So it strikes me, I would think intuitively through this entire conversation, in order to understand it, you have to index his tokens of I as all being with the same person. However, it seems like perhaps there's room on the kind of view you want to defend, where in principle, what matters more is like the guises. So in principle, what you switch, or in principle, you wouldn't have to co-index or understand all the occurrences of I as the same thing because you have different guises.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting case. I mean, I think there's different ways you could theorize or narrate that. I mean, what I'd be tempted to... So the obvious case is, if Lois Lane, who doesn't know that Clark Kent is Superman, is watching while, Clark Kent goes into a revolving door and then Superman comes out again, what she's supposed to do in that situation is attach the Clark Kent discourse reference to the guy going into the revolving door and then attach the Superman one to the guy coming out of the revolving door. In your case, so I think it's more than just the costume. I think, but I'm a little bit, I don't know. I think an option available to one who takes my position in this situation is to say, well, there might even be, it might be, well, I guess the most natural thing to say, because there's also, I don't read enough, I don't think Superman is a very good superhero, so I don't really know much about him, but I know that he's like, he's also called like Kal-El originally, that's all I know. Anyway, so if this is someone from Krypton, right, then he's just the Kal-El person, like he's neither of those, like even though he's under, like what he's in changing, obviously in front of this person, he's not sort of presenting two separate personas, perhaps. But there's different ways that the case could be described in which, maybe he does assume a different person. So it's just the case is a little undescribed, and I think there's different things you could say. It could be just that it's the Superman persona all the way through, because that's the real one, and Clark Kent is a disguise or something. But I think there's just different options that you could have, and I think probably learning a bit more about the sociology here might be helpful, but I don't know enough. I'm new to most of this, yeah, in case it wasn't obvious.
In the middle here.
Hi, my name is Alastair Merlin. I have often been wondering how indexicals and proper names behave differently in context change, and it's been hard to find the right kind of linguistic examples, but I've always found a very nice little children's poem by Milne, maybe you might know it, to be at least a good puzzle. Can I read it to you, please?
Yes, please. Yes, I'd be honored. Thank you.
This is by Milne. If I were John, and John were me, then he'd be six, and I'd be three. If John were me, and I were John, I shouldn't have these trousers on. So, us being philosophers, we see that being of a certain age is a necessary property in a fixed context, I would say, right? But having trousers on in a fixed context is, I would like to think, as a contingent property. It's something, you know, could have been the same context, but I just happened to take the red trousers, all right? In any case, there's a distinction between the two properties. So this sort of indicates that the who is doing the identification matters, and how the identification is matter is how the identification is accomplished, I would say, affects the way the new context establishes mm-hmm. under counterfactual. Right? I don't know whether you could think on the spot of what's going on, but perhaps it touches on what the issues are that you are addressing.
Yeah, I don't think so. However, I love the poem, and it's A.A. Milne, is it?
Yeah.
One of my very first papers that I wrote in graduate school was about these asymmetries in interpreting counterfactuals. Mm. I don't think I want to subscribe to the analysis that I came up with then, but I remember at the time thinking something about argument structure and theta structure is important to them. I would need to, perhaps there's time to sit down later and I could write the poem down and have a go at what's going on. But Nelson Goodman has very similar examples, right? Do you know these? Yeah, so he has these examples like, does anyone remember the Nelson Goodman examples? If Chicago was in Texas, it would be in the South or something like that. But like, you know, that sounds true, but like in principle, Chicago could be in Texas by Texas being in a different location or something like that. So there's something that's held fixed and another thing that moves, and it has this structure of like background and thing that moves against the background that is something that people interested in theater roles talk about. So I have a very distant memory of things like that, but I don't think it necessarily boils. I mean, having the indexicals in there makes it extra interesting, I agree. But I think the basic asymmetry might have a different source. That would be my guess. Yeah.
Could you pass the microphone along for the next question?
But thanks so much for that question.
Which is...
There's another reference I should give you as well.
This feels like a philosopher's example. Next question.
Thanks, great talk. I'm not sure I understood the view completely. So it seems to me that in Onofre's example, the speaker and the hearer do not know each other personally, because in particular the speaker doesn't know the hearer personally. Does it matter for your view?
I mean, very cleverly, Onofre has picked a case that looks really good and that for the view I have here looks very bad. But I guess what I would say is the rule that one can extract from what he says, which is basically like, as long as you can sort of, well, you can only, from his, so basically here's what he said. He's very careful. So he says something like this, the H is at the concert and sees the pianist stand up and then utter the sentence, for some reason, I am a musician, absurdly. It's an absurdist concert. And So in just registering the physical body, right, knowing which physical body the utterance is coming from, that's sufficient. It's actually a little stronger than Zeevat. I was gliding over some differences. It's a little stronger than Zeevat's rule. And then something similar happens at the rally. Like, it's not like, I don't know who at this rally is talking. Like, it's clearly that guy on the podium, right? So you physically locate the body and that's sufficient. But I just think what all this wealth of examples shows is that's not in general sufficient, right? So I can, I can try, like I have in a paper I've written a long, detailed, but ultimately not very convincing plea that in that case, one of the utterances, the second utterance of I has not been understood. But I can well believe that as an attempt to draw people's intuitions, it will be unsuccessful. But I just don't think the rule that he's assuming is the right rule. So I think there's something more going on that we need to take into account. And while that may not ultimately rescue the Frege-ian, maybe whatever the rule ends up being still leaves room for an Onofre type example. That's how I'm trying to add to the debate, I guess. Yeah.
We'll go to Francois next.
Thanks. I very much agree with the general idea that you presented, but it raises an issue that actually I wanted to ask after Hans talk. I wanted to, because he didn't mention files, but not the said file. And here you have a talk about I, and you didn't mention the self file, so that's interesting. You mentioned the file that the interpreter has to basically activate when processing I, but there's an issue about the person who says I has a file about himself or herself. That doesn't seem relevant in all those cases, but except that you mentioned a case in which there is someone says I, and then the other person says you, and there is this exchange. I think that when you say you to someone, there is this requirement that the person you're addressing should actually somehow activate their own self-I in understanding what the speaker has said. So I think that the self-I has a role to play in this, even though it's not mentioned at all and it has no role to play in your account. So can you add it somehow?
Yes. I'm so very glad you asked that question. And I'm also very glad of the reading I did before I came to this workshop, because I pre-formulated a way to answer it. So the argument that you're referring to, you drew my attention to, or if I'd known about it before, I'd forgotten it, which is in Dilip Ninen's 2010 paper, I believe. Is that the one you're talking about? So he argues, I can't remember the case, but it's some complicated thing where there's a mirror and someone's pants are on fire and someone doesn't, thinks that when the speaker says your pants are on fire, they're talking to the person in the mirror, but in fact they're talking directly to that person. Sorry, I haven't described it properly, but the conclusion is that the hypothesis that Dilip makes is that the reason that the explanation for why that sounds like an incorrect an insufficient understanding is that they haven't activated their own self file. They've only got a de re file about themselves, which is for the person in the mirror. So I just think that very account could be explained in a different way. Like there are just two mental files. Like he has a mental file for, maybe it's the self file, maybe it's the encyclopedic file for himself, or the discourse file that tracks the encyclopedic discourse referent for himself, but then he also has a file for the person in the mirror. So it doesn't have to be a self file. There could be another explanation. And then I tried to think of, well, imagine I'm having an out-of-body experience, and so I'm up above, looking down on the situation. There's no mirrors or anything like that. but there's a guy and he's addressing my body, right? And I don't think it's me, right? I'm just having this out-of-body experience. So I don't get the Daisei interpretation. I don't get the activate the self file in some sense. Have I misunderstood that utterance? I'm much less sure about that case. So I actually don't think the correct... I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that Dilip jumps to about that case, though it's such an interesting case, and I had to sit down and think hard about it when I was reading about it recently.
Right, we'll go to Hans next.
Yeah. You hear me?
It's on. Well, I shouldn't be the one you ask because I'm right in front of you.
Okay. So it's very, very simple, and perhaps a bit stupid observation, but suppose that I've given a talk in the morning and I come back to the hotel and in my mailbox there is a little note saying, I thought you were absolutely awful. And, okay, I mean, this is actually just in support of what everything you've been saying. There is a sense in which I have no difficulty interpreting this I, but it doesn't help me. I really would like to know who it was. And there's no difference, in some sense, between this case and the case where I find in my mailbox, you were absolutely awful. There's no mentioning of the I, but in both cases, I want
yes.
to know who it was.
Good. No.
And so that is a legitimate question to ask about what the function of such communications is. And if I understand you correctly, the theory of I in the spirit of Heng Sehgard tells you nothing about that.
Yes. No, there's two aspects of that question that I would love to respond to, but I don't know if there's time. So one aspect is I first started thinking of this actually in terms of examples that don't involve I, but they didn't get into this version of the talk. So people here will know much more about this than me, but I got from my colleague Josh Armstrong the following information about primate affiliative calls, which are just phonologically or phonetically simple, right? So they're not syntactically complex, presumably, and they don't contain pronouns or anything like that. But to understand an affiliative call, you have to do more than just register the call, infer that there was someone making the call, and infer that there was an addressee of the call. So what the call means is something like, let's be on good terms again, something like that. After a battle or something like that, they'll make these affiliative calls. If you're an onlooker, or especially if you're the addressee, you need more specific social information. You need to know, and in the paper I sort of anthropomorphize this by calling it name-like information, but it's, you need to know that it's Comet that affiliated with Misty, right? It's not just whoever issued the utterance affiliated with the other. And it's only once you have that information that you understand the call. But there's no I in that, right? The same goes to interpret that utterance, I guess. Maybe it's not true of every utterance, like some generic street signs or something like that. You don't have to figure out who the author was, but certainly within animals, it might be true too. So you might not need to figure out who's issuing the alarm call. I mean, the only reason you would is to see if maybe they're not reliable or something like that. But in essence, if you could trust reliability, then it's not important who's issuing the alarm call. It's what, you know, what we have to, which direction we have to run in or whatever, right? So, certain things, I agree with you, you'll need to figure out who's making it in order to fully understand it. The other aspect that I just want to touch on really quick, because it'll be obvious how it goes, is Millikan talks about, because it could be an anonymous, deliberately anonymous thing. So Millikan talks about like anonymous threatening phone calls or something like that. And that would be a case where, you know, in old noir movies, they would take out their handkerchief and hold it over the the phone, right? So that would be a case where your social persona is being masked. So that would be the sort of case where the correct interpretation, even though you would want to find out who it is, all that understanding, even robust understanding, requires is that you create a new file for that person. If that person calls back again, you've got to access, and they're, as it were, occupying the same persona, you've got to access that same, you know, oh, I wonder if it's that same caller again. You know, you've got to do that kind of thing. But the first time, you don't have to recognize that it's your disgruntled employee or whatever it is in order to understand properly, as much as you would like to know. Yeah.
Thank you.
So I think this is a follow-up.
Yeah. So I was just curious exactly at, I guess, the mirror of these cases where it feels to me that if I would knock on the restroom and someone would say, I'm inside, it would feel absurd to say, I don't understand, who are you? I feel like in those cases, it feels like the meaning is completely figured out to the maximal degree that in that sort of QD we care about meaning. And I wonder how, like, whether the conversational goal guides, like, generally we are really interested in who's speaking and who's I, but I still wonder whether it's driven by our conversational goals rather than our search for sentence meanings.
Right. And in particular, I think in that case, if it is someone familiar to you, you might precisely not want to know who it is, and they might not want you to know. Just a small thing on this before I try to answer it properly. It's interesting that you bring up that example because my colleague Gabe Greenberg used that to argue in favor of the view because he said, actually, it's very strange if someone tries to get into the toilet stall that you're occupying to say, in English at least, I'm in here. It's very weird to say that, actually. I would usually say, oh, occupied, or someone's in here, or something like that. And at first I thought that was arguing in favor of the view, like because it's the anonymous context. But I was convinced when I put this into an early version of the talk that that's not quite, almost no one shared that intuition, and it's not quite the right description of the situation. So I think it's actually a complicated situation involving, the explanation might be something involving politeness or something. It might be something more complicated that I haven't figured out. But I think an easier, a less conflicted case would be just like supermarket checkout, like, oh, I can bag those for you, something like that, right? And just remember that the view is supposed to be that if it's someone known to you, that's the only case where you have to sort of, the first obvious thing to say is at the supermarket checkout or at a random public toilet, you probably don't have a long-term file for that person. So in fact, interpreting it on my view would just involve starting a new file, so it's no big deal. But I think I think it's quite likely, since I always go to the same Whole Foods, that I probably have encountered some of the people at the supermarket checkouts before. I don't think the churn is that bad that I would never encounter the same people. And usually, actually, they're quite... the checkout people at Whole Foods are usually, quite flamboyantly dressed or tattooed or something like that, so I should probably recognize them. But even then, I suppose I might not take the trouble. But I actually feel like there's something a bit icky about that. Like, you sort of, in some ideal way, you want to recognize your barista again when you get, when they make you a drink, or at least a certain level. Like, there's something about treating another human being as a completely anonymous cipher that's slightly rude. And so I just think it's a great case. It doesn't really support my view, but it's a good place to dive in and do more research. Yeah, so there's a lot to say about it.
Kyle.
Hi, thanks, Sam.
Hey.
Am I right? You want to say in the pianist case, the audience person, they don't understand.
In the which case, sorry?
When the person says, I'm a musician.
Oh, right, yeah.
You want to say there's a sense in which they don't understand that sentence. Is that?
Yeah, yes. So the case needs to be elaborated, okay, a lot. So it could, I mean, One possible elaboration, but I don't think it's the one that Andrea Nofri intended, is that the musician and the politician assume different guises. They're like Clark Kent and Superman. If that was the case, then understanding is perfect. He started a new file in each case, and that's what he's supposed to do. Okay, but I assume the development of the case is meant to be something like this. I guess the guy is Jan Ignacy Paderewski, right? So I assume he's such a polymath that he's giving a concert in the morning and then delivering a speech in the afternoon, and that's just his regular day. And you know, he's assuming that everyone can recognize him. But I also would imagine that at the concert, you know, on the program, his name is there, he's introduced, at the rally, he's introduced. So there's actually all this stuff in place, presumably. He doesn't just sort of anonymously swan around doing these things. So there's all this stuff in place that would suggest that there's, I don't know, like support for robust understanding. But this person, H, just so happens, arrived at the concert late, didn't get the program, the programs had run out, then dashes off to the, and walks past the political rally on the way home. The guy's too far away to even recognize his face, and that's the extent of it. So I think that if I was to try to make the case, even though Paderewski is presenting the same, enacting the same social persona in each case, this is something that H has missed. And in some sense, through no fault of her own, but there was plenty of stuff there that would allow her to recognize that it was the same person again, but she just kind of missed all that stuff. So that's the kind of stuff I would push on to try to make my view of the situation more plausible. But I agree that if you don't start off thinking that this has something going for it, you probably won't be convinced.
So in the version of the case where H can deduce this afterwards by reflecting, would you say in that case the fact that they're able to kind of go, oh, maybe it was the same guy, that would betray the fact that they were understanding even in this more robust sense of interest to you? Like, did that?
Oh, they would have. Yeah, if they deduce it later, then they would understand. Yeah,
so it's really something about like a straight up Frege case where they're not going to arrive at a verdict about the identity just on reflection.
Could you say more about what direction you're pressing me? Because I'm just not sure how
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to figure out what is this more robust notion of understanding.
Oh, the more robust notion is that if you are already familiar with the person under the social persona that they are presenting. So technically H has encountered that person, unless they treated the piano concert as a fully anonymous situation, then they started a long-term mental file for the pianist that they just saw, right? So they have a long-term mental file. Paderewski has not changed his presentation in the meantime the way Clark Kent going into a revolving door does. Hence, the robust sense would require that this person is familiar under this persona, hence they order, to understand their utterance of I, they need to recognize that it's this person again. And I agree that it sounds implausible, and that's why the example seems to work, but the rest of the stuff in the talk is supposed to make you at least feel that I have something to say about the case, I suppose. I don't think I'm going to win people over about the case necessarily, because I think it is well constructed.
So next to you.
Hi, thanks. So I guess this is in the same ballpark. So clarification question about the recognition requirement on understanding. So for example, would you say in the Onofre case, so the second utterance of I am a musician, would it count as recognition for the interpreter to identify the producer of the utterance with the person that they're now seeing, that is addressing them? Does that count, or would it have to be across context, etc.?
Yeah, across. So the thought is, if they start, if they have a file for the pianist that they saw earlier that day, this is just the view, then that person is someone they know of. And so when they see that person again, as long as they're not in disguise or something like that, then understanding requires them to resolve their presence, their face or whatever it is, their voice, if it's on the phone, to that familiar file.
Okay, so you mean recognition in a stronger sense, but then I thought this was a bit too strong, because maybe it's because I think of it in of communication in a Gricean way, but I would have thought that what is required for understanding depends on what the speaker expects of the hearer. So if the speaker expects to be familiar to their hearer, then yes, of course, it's required of the hearer too.
But
if they, for example, they don't remember talking to this addressee and they don't expect to be familiar to them, then I wouldn't see why it would be required of the hearer too.
Yes, I agree. And so, like, the other thing is the sort of anonymous context of the audience. Like, it's this kind of crowd in the second case. So I think things would play out a bit differently if it was a face-to-face conversation. But it would be strange. So there's two different kinds of case, basically. There's a kind of face-to-face case where the Paderewski, as it were, wants to remain incognito. Like, I'll have a conversation with this person, but I don't want this person to recognize me. So I imagine, like, a lot of Hollywood stars wandering around LA probably do something like that, right? Well, maybe that's the opposite, but anyway. So in that case, it does depend. Like, in that sense, it does depend on that Gricean thought you had. It's whatever the speaker wants. If the speaker is trying to be incognito and maybe they succeed or don't, but then that would condition what the hearer needs to do to understand them in a face-to-face conversation. But I'm presuming at the political rally, like I said, he wants everyone to recognize that he's Paderewski. He wants same thing at the piano concert. He wants everyone to recognize that he's Paderewski. So that's why I was assuming that it was the same thing in both cases. But in a sense, it's exactly what you said.
So there, we are out of time. Thank you all for your attention. Thanks for a great talk. I'll just remind you that we're starting again at tomorrow morning at 10, and this is the last talk for today. So join me in thanking Sam for a great presentation.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.